Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, economic insecurity has become a general fact of American life, but especially so for blacks and Latinos. And Rwandan President Paul Kagame, one of Washington's top allies in Africa, is the greatest mass killer on the face of the earth today, says author and activist Edward Herman.
But first, for New Orleans, it's been a commemoration, but certainly not a celebration of 5 years since Hurricane Katrina. And the weeks after the disaster hit, the city's African American Leadership Project was instrumental in drawing up the New Orleans Citizens' Bill of Rights, including the right of all displaced people to return to their city. M10 Gulizi Senyike is head of the Leadership Project. We ask him to assess the accomplishments and failures of the past 5 years.
We are happy that we were able to influence policy of local government to ensure that everybody, that all the neighborhoods had an equal right to receive services, because once the power elites saw that they were not going to win on the footprint reduction, the green dot thing, where the whole Lower Nine and New Orleans East would be turned into the green dot areas, when they saw they weren't going to win there, the next strategy was to limit services, which in effect chokes off a neighborhood if you, you know, limit public services available to them. So we were happy that we were able to get legislation passed to prevent that kind of discrimination from taking place, compelling the city to service areas equally and not discriminate based on damage that had occurred. And so we're happy about that. We're happy that we helped to keep the question of right to return in the public consciousness. We're happy that we compelled the city council to recognize the neighborhood plans and prioritize the most devastated neighborhoods as the ones most in need of, you know, of public resources. I mean, there's some things we think we accomplished and did, but there's some battles we lost. For instance, the increased unaffordability of the city. Rents have gone up as much as 45%. Market dynamics intervened, and we didn't win that. We were opposed to this whole-scale demolition of public housing, but the city council unanimously supported it, including the progressives on the council, because some of them thought that it was a good thing to do. We didn't. We thought it could have been done without whole-scale demolition. It could have been revitalization without whole-scale demolition. But we didn't win on that, and I think the consequence would be even fewer units available to, you know, to lower-income people. So we didn't win on that. We didn't stop the police from their reckless, irresponsible behavior, though. To be fair about it, you know, the Justice Department is presently involved in New Orleans trying to address that, but we didn't stop that. On the school front, you know, we didn't stop the school takeover from taking place, and now they're claiming all the success and progress that has been made as a result of the takeover. But what they are admitting as publicly so is that before the storm, the average investment per pupil was averaging around $5,000. Now it's around $14,000 as a result of Katrina infusion money from the federal government. So if the federal government doesn't sustain that infusion, then those results will evaporate very quickly. So we've got, you know, mixed reactions to what happened in that regard. We're not happy that our city council is now 5 white and 2 black in a city that is 60% or more African American. We're not happy about that. It is what it is. We're not happy that we that the mayoralty was lost to a non-African American, which is not to berate the present mayor, but, you know, certainly after 35 or so years of holding that position. We're not happy that we lost it. We're not happy about the distribution of the contracts and the money. The big question is, what happened to the money? How did it get distributed? We don't see African Americans in significant numbers as having received a lot of the Katrina dollars. So there's some things we won, there's some things we didn't win, and the struggle continues. It's not over. There's still 40,000 or more African Americans, Orleanians, right here in the Houston area. And there are more in Atlanta and Baton Rouge and Memphis and places like that. So in the aggregate, there's about a good 100,000 who are still out, many of whom may never come back. So there are things to be, you know, joyous about in some ways, and there are some things we think we accomplished with other community organizers. There's some things that we didn't accomplish, and I am really concerned, as many of us are, not just in the African American Leadership Project, but many organizers are concerned about the direction that the city may be taking, which will continue to program black people and poor people out, turn out to be like Aspen, Colorado. You can work here, but you can't live here. It's too costly for you to live here. So you commute in here from the outer suburbs, which is where the poverty is now moving, is to the surrounding suburbs and out of Orleans Parish. So there's some real concerns, Glenn, that that we have about direction and what we've seen in 5 years. To be sure, she ain't what she used to be. The city has changed, and it's whiter, it's richer, it's more gentrified, and I think it's less welcoming to people of color at the lower end of the spectrum, although we are still in the city and still present in it, and the cultural apparatus has certainly made part of its way back. So there's some things to be noted that are on the upside and some things on the downside.
Let's take a look outside, get an assessment of the behavior, conduct of those forces outside of New Orleans, the established political forces such as the Congressional Black Caucus and other members of government, and the kind of response to the plight in New Orleans from grassroots folks around the country.
First of all, we want to applaud people of all races and nationalities in this country who responded to the plight of New Orleans with their love, with the opening of their arms and with their dollar resources. Many of them came to the city and volunteered and still do. There was an incredible grassroots response from the whole of the country to the plight of Orleanians. And for that, we are certainly thankful and appreciative to everybody in this country. And by the way, outside of this country, because there were many international responses as well, who offered to help and who in fact did help. So we appreciate all of that. The Congressional Black Caucus certainly has been consistent in its concern for New Orleans. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, in particular, has been very, very aggressive about trying to ensure that New Orleans stays on the national agenda and that is, that resources be directed there. Clyburn from South Carolina, the congressman from Mississippi who chairs Homeland Security, I think that's Benny Thompson. He too has been aggressive and consistent. And so we've had good support there. The bigger problem, of course, has been freeing up the resources. Because the current administration, the Obama administration, inherited a mess from the predecessor Bush administration, whose response to New Orleans at best could be called ambivalent, and at worst just negligence, just sheer negligence. But that administration was terribly inconsistent in its concern for New Orleans. The Obama administration came to office and announced that it was indeed going to put New Orleans high on its agenda for resources and federal assistance in the effort to rebuild the Gulf Coast and that city. And they have been consistent in that regard. For instance, when the president took office, there was about $2 to $2.5 billion of federal money that was frozen that had been approved but unallocated, because somehow between Washington, D.C. and Baton Rouge and the city, the money just never found its way to the ground. The Obama administration freed up that money that was stuck, and that money is now available. That happened during the Reagan administration, but it will be implemented during the current Landrieu administration. But it did happen. The president did talk to then-Mayor Ray Nagin to ensure that those monies were freed up, and the president kept his word, you know, and unfroze those dollars. And we're starting to see some of the effects of that in our infrastructure investments, for instance, that we're presently witnessing in improvements in roads and police stations and libraries and things like that, public infrastructure, is what I'm describing here. We see a definite change in the attitude and behavior of the federal government. We see continued support from the Congressional Black Caucus.
5 years ago, many of us said, I know I said, that if the assault on Black New Orleans wasn't a catalyst for a renewed grassroots mass movement among Black people, then nothing ever would be. What were your expectations?
There were some things that I assumed could be operative. One is that there had to be a FEMA response, and two, there was the possibility of citizen organizing. But outside of that, the question of mobilizing African Americans and other progressive people around the human suffering of New Orleans and around the bureaucratic failure of New Orleans, to me, I'm not sure what I expected, because the government was absorbed with the Iraq War, and this was not a government that, in my opinion, was favorable to African-American interests at all for political reasons. The previous administration, the Bush administration, I don't think favored the interests of African-Americans at all, and so I'm not sure what I expected. But at the point of the tragedy, I minimally expected America to use all the power of the federal government to respond to what was happening to its citizens. It flunked that test. We know that it flunked that test. Now, as far as mobilizing Black people in a broader sense, I think the response, the compassionate response of the Black community was evident to us. But beyond that, I think that what we expected people to grasp was the level of indifference. We wanted Black folks to see the level of indifference being displayed by the federal government as a signal, an indication to them. That was one thing. The second thing was that they should perceive themselves as being imminently vulnerable to disaster. And how well prepared were they to take care of themselves? What we tried to say to everybody is the message here is you got to take care of yourself. You can't assume that public agencies are going to do that. You got to have a plan and a provision in your own community, in your neighborhood, on how are you going to recover in the event of a disaster, because disasters are imminent. You can't control them, whether it's earthquakes or fires or oil spills or tornadoes or other kinds of disasters, that you have to have a plan. And we found that most African Americans didn't have a plan, that we were doing more to help others than they were doing to help us, because everybody was caught off guard and in shock about what happened to Black people in New Orleans, and they didn't believe that they were witnessing what they witnessed. But very few other places, Glenn, had a real plan for what to do. So part of the mobilization that happened was helping people to respond, not just in terms of what to do about New Orleans, but what to do about your own community. What is your own level of preparation? What's your own level of readiness? We do think that Katrina scared a lot of Black folks into seeing that they were vulnerable and that they could not, in fact, rely on the federal government. So they got mobilized, all right, but they got mobilized in another and different kind of way. The mobilization to help us, we did see that. I mean, we saw that as people went to the different cities, I think 47 states or something like that, where we were dispersed to. We certainly saw responses, affirmative responses on the part of African Americans who did mobilize to provide assistance. I myself, for instance, visited New York, visited Boston, visited California, and many other cities, and spoke there, had public gatherings to give people up-to-date information. And there was a lot of support, just a lot of support to help New Orleanian families to readjust their lives, you know, with, you know, employment, schools for the children, accessing the healthcare system. I mean, I think there was a good and marvelous response, people to people, from African Americans especially, and black people who came to the different cities across the country. Every bit of data we received said that that was a positive mobilization. But again, the mobilization happened in reverse in terms of educating people about the level of exposure and vulnerability. That was good, too. Now, as far as a broader mass movement, I think it probably was evident in the election of 2008, the Obama election. I think part of that was the pent-up frustration of black people with the Bush administration and its relative indifference and insensitivity to the interests and needs of black people. And Katrina was exhibit number one, that if there was any uncertainty about how that particular party might respond, the Republican Party might respond, Katrina was exhibit number one for a lot of black people that we talked to. And so I think that you saw one form of mass mobilization in the Obama election, the general frustration with the Republican Party, the conservative party, and Katrina was certainly a part of what shaped people's consciousness about that party's indifference. So we think that that was one of the contributing factors to the election of President Barack Hussein Obama, and that was certainly that was a good thing. To have happened. But these other vital lessons, too, about your own preparation, your own readiness, how will you take care of yourself, how will you take care of your neighbors in the event of a disaster, we think there was some mobilization about that. Now, we haven't gone back to check to see if those local plans are in place, but that's one of the things we're trying to find out from people to see if indeed they've done that. I know in at least five places there has been a lot of progress in that regard, but there's no data that would suggest a more systematic response in that way. The one other thing that the experience has revealed is the depth of the racist class nature of the capitalist system here. Because, you know, Amy Klein in the book Shock Doctrine suggests the term disaster capitalism and that New Orleans was really a test case. And indeed, she was absolutely right, because privatization is the order of the day. The school system has been privatized, you know, with public funding. Now the New Orleans Recreation Department is at least going to be semi-privatized. The economic development function is slated for semi-privatization. Indeed, the consequence post-Katrina has been this notion that government is not the most effective way to deliver, but that's also being accelerated because of the racial change that has happened post-Katrina. And we will see this increasing move towards privatization of services, this more conservative approach to delivery. And the takeover that indeed has taken place has opened the door to invite this notion that the services should be privatized out. The more black political power is achieved, the more there is a tendency towards decentralization of power, to remove power from the office of the mayor and to decentralize it and spread it out into other structures, or to move towards the regionalism concept. And in the case of New Orleans, we've seen both things happening. The weakening of the mayor's power by decentralization, as well as an increased emphasis on regionalism, all of which has the effect of diluting the effectiveness of black political power, such as it is, but diluting its effectiveness and Privatizing also means putting dollars into the hands of those who already have it, white corporations and firms and businesses that already have it, and less of those resources go into the hands of African Americans, other people of color, local firms, or women's firms. We certainly see that that's one of the impacts that Katrina has had. More white people are in the city than were there before, higher levels of gentrification, and even further displacement of African Americans. So we've got a lot that we're worried about the stability of African American people in the city over time, because the forces of the marketplace, you know, the dynamics of the capitalist market are imposing new kinds of pressures in New Orleans that we did not see in the same way before Katrina.
Mtangulizi Sanyika of the New Orleans African American Leadership Project. Paul Kagame, the president of the tiny African nation of Rwanda and a staunch ally of the United States, is the greatest mass killer on the face of the earth today. So says Edward S. Herman, the noted author and activist. Herman and David Peterson have a new book out titled The Politics of Genocide, in which they explore the word games and doublespeak the United States deploys to mask its own and its allies' crimes against humanity. Mass killings come in various flavors, depending upon whether the United States supports the killings or wants to vilify somebody else. Those categories, according to Herman and Peterson, are constructive genocide, the kind the U.S. commits, nefarious genocide, killings committed by the other guy, benign bloodbaths, killings that work out well for U.S. policy, and mythical bloodbaths, mass murders that really never happened but are invented by the U.S. to demonize an enemy. Edward Herman explains.
Well, these are used sort of ironically. The way the world works, and the way the political system and the media work, is when we do the killing, when we do mass killing, I say in Vietnam, never called this genocide. This is a constructive endeavor. So we in our book, and in an earlier book I did with Chomsky, we talk about constructive bloodbaths. And in this new book, we talk about constructive genocide. They're the ones that we carry out. And again, I say it's ironical. Since we do it, it has to be benevolent. It has to be good. It has to be justifiable. So a constructive genocide is a mass killing that we do. And it's constructed because we do it. And we're the good guys. If a client does it, for example, in Indonesia, where there was a huge bloodbath back in 1965-66, we call this a benign bloodbath, meaning we don't get really upset about it. We just take it as a given and just sort of let it go. In fact, in the case of the Indonesia genocide, we actually were fairly enthusiastic because they were clearing up the Communist Party and a left opposition in Indonesia. And when Indonesia went into East Timor and resulting in the death of maybe a quarter or a third of the population, that also was benign. And we actually quietly supported that. But then if an enemy does this, if Saddam Hussein kills a lot of people, or if Milosevic engages in violent actions, these are our targets. Therefore, these are nefarious actions. We also use the term mythical for cases where we claim bloodbaths or mass killings or genocide when they weren't even real. We talk about this in connection with the Rakach massacre. So anyway, these are sort of cynical, ironic terms to describe the fact that we use words to fit our political needs.
So, for example, in Iraq, when Saddam Hussein kills a lot of Kurds, that would fall under the nefarious category. But when the Americans kill a whole bunch of Iraqis, that is under the constructive genocide category.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, we talk about the sanctions of mass destruction in Iraq, which we imposed with the British through the UN in the 1990s, where hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died because we had destroyed their sanitation systems and they had serious disease. In the very famous episode that is really worth citing, in 1996, Madeleine Albright on national television was asked whether the death of 500,000 Iraqi children as a real result of these sanctions was worth it. And she said, yes, it was worth it. So here you had 500,000 children dying, and the United States Secretary of State says that it was worth it. Now, this is a pretty serious genocide. Of course, it wasn't picked up in the rest of the media. We did it. So it was a constructive genocide, just as the invasion. I mean, we killed another 500,000 or a million, or they died, that number died in the invasion occupation from 2003, but that also was constructive. So the word genocide is not used to describe these things in the American media. But if what Saddam does it, when he went after his Kurds, as you say, when he used chemical warfare at Halabja, this was a genocidal act.
You list the Darfur wars and the killings there, and the conflict in Rwanda, and the mass killings of millions in the Democratic Republic of Congo as being treated as nefarious genocides by the United States. Please explain.
Well, Darfur, of course, is a case where you have an Arab country and an oil-rich country, but where China has made inroads, it's therefore a potential target. And when people, a lot of people died there in tribal wars and sometimes foreign-sponsored invasions, but also some nasty actions from the central government, we got up on our high horse. There were all kinds of campaigns carried out to save Darfur, and the International Criminal Court has indicted the head of state of Sudan for this. But in the case of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you had many, many more people killed, there have been no indictments there. That's a state that has been invaded by Kagame and Museveni from Uganda. And these are our friends, so this doesn't qualify as genocide. Darfur qualifies as genocide. Kagame is exempt from International Criminal Court proceedings, and so is Museveni.
Somalia is not listed on those genocides, in those genocide categories, but the United Nations at one point described the Somali situation right after the Ethiopian invasion, which was backed by the United States, as the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa.
The United States wanted to go into Somalia. It was an Islamic government that was there for a while, and the United States has oil. It's a vulnerable state. It's near Djibouti. The United States is trying to increase its power in Africa. So Somalia is a vulnerable state, and one that the United States does not want to be Islamic, wants to control. Many of its problems are a result of U.S. intervention and support of the Ethiopian invasion and its destabilization effort. We have in a large measure created the crisis in Somalia, but we want to be there to help control it. So we have a responsibility to protect there.
So the responsibility to protect does not mean responsibility to protect Somalis, but responsibility to protect U.S. interests.
Absolutely. But, of course, it's always couched in terms of the responsibility to protect the people involved.
You write in your book that the Western propaganda line on Rwanda, where President Kagame presides, turns the perpetrator and the victim of mass killings upside down. What did you mean?
Well, in the Western establishment view, Kagame is the savior of Rwanda. He came in and stopped the genocide. In fact, if you read the papers the last few days about the Rwanda election, the papers always refer to the fact that Hutu death squads killed 800,000 to 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus in the genocide that occurred in 1994. That's the standard model, but that standard model is a lie. Actually, Kagame himself was the man principally responsible for the mass killings in Rwanda. He's been trying to take over Rwanda for years. He invaded Rwanda from Uganda in 1990. With U.S. help, he penetrated the Rwanda government and infiltrated troops into Rwanda. The shootdown of the president's plane on April 6, 1994, that everybody admits was the triggering event that started the genocide, was actually carried out by Kagame and his forces. And he was really ready. Within 2 hours of that shootdown, his forces were fighting, and they conquered Rwanda in 100 days. Also, another very important point that people don't recognize is that the UN didn't come in to help in this situation because the United States voted for a drawdown of UN troops in April 1994, which is what Kagame wanted. Now, why did he want a drawdown in UN troops if the Hutus were doing mass killing? The answer is he was doing the mass killing. He was the leading killer. He didn't want the UN to be obstructing him. And another thing that's really important to understand is that the census of Rwanda in 1991 showed only 600,000 Tutsis. And after the mass killings, according to the survivors organ, there were still 300,000 at least. So that means the difference between the two is 300,000. That means at most 300,000 were killed. Well, if 800,000 and 1 million were killed, that leaves 500,000 or 700,000 Hutus. And the evidence is that it was mainly Hutus were killed, not Tutsis. In fact, in their book, we cite an internal State Department memo of December 1994, in which it's stated that the RPF, Kagame's forces, were killing 10,000 Hutu civilians a month. This is a State Department internal memo. That's a lot of civilians per month. And also, we ought to stress the fact that Kagame, after he took over control of Rwanda, didn't stop there. He went into the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and he's been in and out of there, allegedly chasing Hutu genocidists. But a UN report a couple of years ago said that in Kagame's area of control in the Congo, there had been 3.5 million excess deaths. 3.5 million excess deaths in Kagame's area of control. So actually, if you add that to the hundreds of thousands that he killed in the genocide, which was mainly a Kagame genocide, you're in the realm of 4 million plus. Idi Amin killed maybe 100. The largest estimates of Idi Amin's killings were 300,000. So Kagame's killings are some like 15 times as great as Idi Amin's killings, and yet Kagame is a Western hero. The reason I'm pretty sure that the reason why this is so is that he was a U.S. agent. He actually studied in Fort Leavenworth, and the United States supported him in Uganda. It supported his moves in penetrating Rwanda before the genocide. It helped cool down the UN troops, reduce their number, while right after the the killing started. And it also has suppressed evidence that he was responsible for the shooting down of the president's plane in April 1994. The tribunal had an investigator study this, and he reported to the prosecutor that Kagame had done it. So what she did was consult with the United States and tell them they were dropping the investigation, and they haven't taken it up ever since. So that triggering event, the tribunal has ignored, and the West has ignored, all in order to protect Kagame's image as the savior, when in fact he was the killer. I think actually this turnabout, this upside down thing, is probably the most incredible that I've ever encountered in my life. I mean, to have a guy who, I think Kagame is the greatest mass killer on the face of the earth today, and yet he's an honored leader of, and he's, the United States gives him military aid. We get his troops to help us out in pacification operations in Darfur and elsewhere. And we get him economic aid. He's an honored man. So the question is, who is it that the United States would not honor? I should probably mention that, you know, back we supported Suharto in Indonesia, who was a tremendous killer. And back in 1994, New York Times had a front page article in which they quote a Clinton official saying that Suharto is, quote, our kind of guy. Here's a mass murderer, a dictator, and the liberal Clinton administration welcomes him to Washington, says he's our kind of guy. Well, I guess Kagame is our kind of guy, too. We can sink pretty low on who is our kind of guy. In fact, Saddam Hussein was our kind of guy in the 1980s when he was fighting against Iran. There was that famous picture of Rumsfeld in Baghdad shaking hands with Saddam Hussein and telling him what a fine fellow he was. So Saddam was really, he was also our kind of guy until he crossed the line.
And in fact, in Africa, the regimes in Rwanda and Uganda are the mainstays in terms of U.S. proxies, military proxies in Africa. Uganda is the main force that is propping up the Somali regime, for example. When the Shabab claimed responsibility for a bombing in Kampala, Uganda, the American media said it was an example of the terrorists in Somalia reaching out to destabilize the rest of Africa. Is that the way you see it?
I think that it's actually even some question of who did it. Quite a few people think that Museveni is in electoral trouble and he needs a terrorist act, just like George Bush did. He feeds on being the security protector of Uganda. So it's not absolutely impossible that those bombings were self-inflicted. But insofar, if it's true that that rebel group from Somalia did it, this is arguably part of a war. I mean, it was a really nasty act to carry out against civilians. But as you say, the Uganda army is in Somalia. It's a proxy army for the United States, serving to bring Somalia to heel. So if rebels in Somalia attack Uganda, this is arguably warfare. It's actually an answer to what Museveni has done. Actually, the United States takes upon itself the right to bomb anywhere in the globe now. We say there's a suspected terrorist in Pakistan or Yemen or anywhere else. We can send drones there to shoot them down. I guess that's being kind of generalized. But when other countries do it, that's illicit.
Your book explains how, in fact, your book is really all about the imperial use of words as weapons. So what's all this hoopla really about with the supposed end of the U.S. combat role in Iraq?
That is a beautiful use of words. We still have soldiers there who, in fact, we even have 5,000. We openly admit our combat troops, but the rest of them are well-trained American soldiers who are perfectly capable of engaging in combat. So what we've done is play like we've exited from any combat operations by redefining troops from combat troops to just training troops, advisory groups. I mean, this is standard practice. We're still in Iraq. We're still in aggression occupation mode.
And in fact, they've taken to calling U.S. bases fortified compounds.
Yes, that's a beauty too. I wonder how we can. Of course, we have this embassy. I guess we're still calling that the biggest embassy in the world, just a plain embassy. But it's actually a place big enough to harbor troops and CIA agents. But we use words with a lot of practice skill and with imperial purpose.
This imperial use and abuse of words, what does it do to the political conversation that folks should be having about the policy decisions their country makes on their behalf?
Well, it makes it very difficult, and especially when the media will follow along with the usage of these words and will not challenge them. I mean, if we had an honest and decent media, when you move from combat, redefine troops and call them no longer combat troops, the media should be pointing out that this is a fraud and they should laugh at it. So it's essential in the use of these words to manipulate that the media play along and don't challenge the words, and they don't.
Does the practice of having embedded media, that is reporters embedded in U.S. military outfits, have something to do with this, or is it in the nature of U.S. corporate media to toe whatever line comes from the State Department and the Pentagon?
Well, I think that it's the latter is crucial. I mean, the media are very cooperative with, and they don't challenge the militaries. The embedding was probably a useful little add-on, but it wasn't needed. I mean, we had that scandal, you recall, when it was exposed that the Pentagon had actually encouraged the mainstream media and the networks to take on former military officers as regular commentators on military affairs. And so the numbers and the affiliations of these people that CNN and the rest of them have carried to comment on military affairs, the numbers of those who are military affiliated is staggering, and they actually were even on the military payroll. So, I mean, this was all done voluntarily.
So tell me, Mr. Herman, who is better at the use and abuse of selective terminology, President Bush or President Obama?
Well, that's a tough one. That really is a tough one. President Obama is very smooth. He's very cool and calm and collected, and he's smarter than Mr. Bush, so he's more effective in using these things. And I think he's more effective also as a spokesman for the War Party, because we expected him to be different. He was going to give us change, and people had faith that we were going to move from Bush-Cheney and a permanent war system to a more greater focus on our civilian needs in America, which are huge and growing, and with a cutback of the military and a cutback of warfare. But it hasn't happened. In fact, you can even make a case that with the global use of drones and a more aggressive expansion of NATO, that Mr. Obama has maybe even somewhat escalated our military involvement. Because he's partly influenced by the fact that the Democrats always feel that they must rebut the charge that they're weak on national security, and they don't want to appear like wimps. So in a way, that makes them more dangerous. They have to prove their non-wimpiness, and they do this by dropping bombs and by increasing the military budget. It's a very distressing scene. The language of deception, though, is fairly common. I mean, the use of doublespeak by our leaders, it may be done more smoothly by X than Y, but doublespeak is very important.
Edward Herman and David Peterson's book, The Politics of Genocide, has a foreword by Noam Chomsky.
A large and growing proportion of Americans are economically insecure. That's not just an emotional feeling, but people's actual relationship to the world of work and income. Jacob Hacker of Yale University headed up a study of the problem. Hacker's team came up with what they call an economic security index.
The economic security index, ESI, is a measure of the economic security of American families. And the way it measures economic security is basically looks at the chance that a family will experience a 25% or greater decline in their available household resources, which is basically their income minus their medical costs. So if you have medical costs, that takes away from your income. And so from 1 year to the next, do you experience a 25% or greater decline in those resources and not have an adequate safety net? And it's basically, the measure is just a share of families that experience that decline. And what we found is that chance, that share, has been going up dramatically over the last generation.
So economic insecurity is increasing in the United States. What does that say about America's vaunted, or is it mythical, upward mobility?
Well, what it says is that in addition to upward mobility, which is certainly part of the American experience and has been for a long time, in fact, there's some evidence that that upward mobility has declined in the last 30 years or so. In addition to upward mobility, there's a great deal of downward mobility in the United States. And the kind of downward mobility we're talking about are these sudden, devastating drops in income. An individual who experiences a 25% or greater loss in income might go from, say, $50,000 a year in income to $37,500 or less, and yet not have enough savings to deal with that loss. So these are really devastating shocks, and they're much more frequent than they used to be.
And they are more frequent among blacks and Latinos than among
whites.
Yes,
far more. For example, in 2007, which was supposed to be a period of economic expansion, right on the eve of the Great Recession that we're suffering through today, white Americans had a 12.3% chance of this kind of decline. About 12% of white Americans experienced a drop of 25% or greater, while African Americans experienced a decline in that same year of around 18%. So half again is big. And African Americans have experienced during downturns, economic downturns, levels of economic insecurity in the past that were not achieved by white Americans in any of those downturns. So we're talking about a reality that's across the board. Lots of Americans experience these kind of declines, but which is much more present among African Americans and Hispanics. Hispanics are relatively similar to African Americans in terms of the chance of these kind of large declines.
We also see that 18 to 34-year-olds were very likely to experience economic insecurity. Now, doesn't that portend a more fearful American future, this entire generation experiencing this insecurity?
Well, we'll see what happens, of course. It's always hazardous to predict what the effects of these kinds of shocks will be on Americans. What we do know is that people who experience unemployment and other very large economic shocks early in life seem to suffer those effects for years to come. The research is very clear on this, that during the crucial early years of establishment in the workforce between roughly 18 and 34, these kinds of dislocations have a long-lasting effect because people lose skills that they gained. They have a hard time breaking into the labor market. This is obviously particularly devastating for African Americans and particularly African American men. Right now, we see levels of unemployment in the black community that are really truly astounding and frightening. And that's a whole generation of young men and women who are going to have their formative labor market experiences scarred by these kinds of economic shocks. So we don't know exactly what the effect will be, but it could well be that these kinds of dislocations will live with them for many years to come.
And how should this data inform us in terms of public policy?
Well, I think it has two messages. The first message is that this is really an American experience. We estimate that in 2009, 1 in 5, 20% of Americans, experienced these big economic declines without an adequate safety net. So the first thing to say is that this is not something that's just happening to a fringe of American society. It's really a reality for all Americans. And in that sense, I think what we've learned during this economic downturn is just how long this long-term trend has played out in Americans' lives. And I think a lot of people sort of saw the Great Recession that we're living through as this kind of, you know, bolt out of the blue. But for many Americans, particularly black Americans, they've been living with high levels of insecurity for a long time, and this is just an indicator of how serious the problem is becoming. The second message is that we can act on this. We can respond to this problem because we know, first of all, that 20 or 30 years ago, these kinds of shocks were less frequent. And second of all, we know from the evidence that we've assembled why people are experiencing these dislocations. The two main things are that there's a greater chance that people are going to have these big declines in income and at the same time not have a personal safety net of financial wealth. So we need to do more to try to shield people against labor market dislocations of the sort that cause these kinds of declines, as well as healthcare costs, which turn out to be a big source of risk for many families. And at the same time, we need to think about how do we encourage people to build up financial wealth to deal with these shocks on their own. So government has two roles. We have to have a reasonably strong safety net for the short term, but we also have to have a strategy for the long term to help people build up their own assets to gain their own sources of economic security. And in that sense, I do think both liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, if they can get past the current polarized fight over the role of government, could see a goal here that they would find attractive. For conservatives, the idea of encouraging people to save on their own, to have stable sources of wealth, is something that they've long championed but not always supported. And for those on the left, I think the idea that we need to improve the safety net is now self-evident. And if we can try to bring those two sides together, make the investments necessary to ensure economic security for the future, the hope is that we can reverse this tide of increasing insecurity in the United States.
Well, of course, some people do profit from economic insecurity. When working people are feeling insecure, they tend to make less demands of their bosses.
Yes. I mean, there's no question in my mind that this transformation has been partly caused by the weakening of workers relative to management and business. And I think part of the way in which we could address this problem is to strengthen organized labor, particularly to strengthen unions in parts of the workforce that are most insecure, the service sector, for example. You know, it's ironic that the areas of the workforce that are most secure, such as the public sector, where teachers and firefighters and other workers are employed, tend to have fairly high rates of unionization. That's not a coincidence, obviously. That's part of the reason why they're secure. But there's parts of the economy, low-wage workers, people who are working in restaurants and retail establishments, that are extremely insecure, and yet there's essentially no unions whatsoever. So I think that would help. I think the other thing we should recognize is that business ultimately benefits when people have a basic level of security. Someone who's really worried about losing their job may not demand greater benefits, may not demand greater wages, but they're also not going to invest in their productivity, they're not going to feel loyal to their company. So if we have a higher road to economic productivity and profits, one that may not be quite as great for some employers, but which produces an overall level of prosperity that's much greater and much more stable, then I think we're all better off. So that's the hope, that we can have a win-win situation. But I'm not at all unaware that there's going to be fierce political conflicts and conflicts in the private sector over this goal. I just don't think that Americans can wait any longer to start to demand greater economic security.
Jacob Hacker's Teens Work was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you blackagendareport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.